Hello, and welcome to Asbury Methodist Church's podcast. My name is Forrest DeVinny. I'm the lead pastor at Asbury, and I hope this podcast will enrich your walk with Christ. I hope it will increase your knowledge of the Bible, and I hope it's going to be a little bit entertaining at the very least. We are right in the middle of Lent. Excuse me. We're also right in the middle of allergy season, so I'm dealing with that. I wouldn't say I'm preaching through the Gospel of Matthew during Lent, because I'm not really preaching through the whole thing. But all of my sermons this year during Lent, including my Easter sermon, are all going to be taken from the Gospel of Matthew. And today I want to look at some passages from Matthew that I'm not going to end up covering on Sunday morning, but they are valuable teachings. I think that they're appropriate. I mean, almost any teaching is appropriate for Lent, right? But I think that they are particularly appropriate for this season of not just repentance, but also reflection. Because they really get to the heart of some things that I think we don't often think about. Or at least we don't maybe consciously think about it. Perhaps we're unaware of how much we think about it or of how off the mark our attitudes about these things are, but we're going to cover them anyway. And a lot of this is going to be interrelated. And I'm going to be kind of skipping back and forth a bit between Matthew 18 and Matthew 20. So first things first, we're going to start off in Matthew 18 with the first six verses of Matthew 18. And today I'm reading out of the New American Standard Bible. So it's a bit of a different translation than what I'm used to, but that's what I'm using. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Now, right off the bat, this question, it ought to raise alarm bells for us, right? Because why are they asking the question? Why do they want to know who the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Right? What they're asking a question about status. Now, these are men who, by and large, don't have much status in the world they live in. Maybe Matthew did before he followed Jesus because he was a tax collector. So even if the local Jewish people didn't consider him a person of status, certainly the government and the economic authorities did. He would have had wealth. He would have had some status. The rest of them probably not so much. And of course, once they follow Jesus, they all go to the very bottom rung of the social ladder. So I have to wonder if maybe they're asking this question because they're trying to figure out just how much following Jesus is going to pay off. Now remember, remember what their mindset is. When they talk about the kingdom of heaven, they're not talking about the afterlife. When they talk about the kingdom of heaven, that is their term for what they think is going to happen when Jesus finally does overthrow the Romans and reestablish the physical, geographical kingdom of Israel. The political nation state of Israel. That's what they're thinking. That's what their mind is on. What they're really getting at is, once we ditch these Romans, how much power are you going to give us? And you have to imagine that at this point, they're thinking of the Pharisees who have tormented them. They're thinking of the people who have mocked them. They're probably on some level thinking of the people who have been their enemies in one way or another for their whole life. They might be thinking of the people who said they'd never amount to anything, of the people who called them foolish for following Jesus. They're thinking of vindication, right? They're thinking of power. And most importantly, they're still not thinking about what the kingdom is actually like and what it's going to be. Their entire mindset is off. And so Jesus does this. He called a child to himself and set him among them and said, truly, I say to you, unless you change and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So whoever will humble himself like this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. That's a harsh rebuke. We normally read this passage as like a really nice, loving, touchy-feely thing where Jesus says, let the children come to me, right? He called the child to himself. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. But this is a really harsh, very stinging rebuke of his own disciples, right? Unless you change and become like this child, you're not even going to be in the kingdom. Man. Now we have to think about what that actually means. Because we don't know anything about this particular child other than the fact that he was called by Jesus to come to where Jesus was, and he went. That's literally all we know. Jesus calls the child shows up, that's the only thing we know. Then Jesus says, unless you all change and become like this child, you won't even get into the kingdom. So what does it mean? I wonder, some people have posited all kinds of theories about this, right? Well, be like a child, right? A child is humble, and a child doesn't seek status, and a child, all these things, they say all these things that make me think, you've never been around children, have you? Children absolutely seek status. Children absolutely are selfish and prideful and arrogant. Children are sinners just like we are. There is, however, a level of innocence with children that we don't have as adults. Some of that is born of ignorance, right? I mean, my 3.5-year-old child isn't malicious. Now, she does things she shouldn't do. And she doesn't listen when she should. And she makes mistakes. And she does things that could very easily be interpreted as mean or cruel, except she doesn't have malicious intent behind them. And there is something to that in terms of what Jesus means, I think, right? That there is a level of innocence, right? We talk as Wesleyans about entire sanctification, and part of what that means is no more willful sinning, right? No sinning intentionally, no sinning when you know what you're doing is wrong, but that you will still make mistakes, right? You will still sin unintentionally. I do think that's part of what Jesus means, but it's only part of it. Because he's also got these disciples who are imagining that the kingdom of heaven is going to be all about overthrowing the Romans and reestablishing their great glorious kingdom of Israel and going back to the glory days. And then they're specifically wondering, how much power is Jesus going to give us in this new kingdom? They're plotting. They're angling for something. And that is something that is beyond the scope of what a child would do. Now, they might plot an angle for, like, a piece of candy, but they don't seek political power. Their problems are simple, and their goals are simple. Unless you change. The other part about that's nice about children is it's easy for children to change. Children are not set in their ways. Children are malleable. You can mold them and shape them. And when they have gotten an idea into their head that's wrong, it's actually fairly easy to get it out of their head. This is why Proverbs says, train up a child in the ways he should go, and when he's old, he will not stray from them. Because children are malleable and trainable, and adults are much less so. Part of what Jesus is telling them is, you've got the wrong idea about the kingdom of heaven and what it's going to be, and unless you get out of that mindset and become as teachable and trainable as this child, you are not going to get into the kingdom of heaven. And this should really concern all of us, because if there's one thing I am dead certain of, it's that we all have ideas about the kingdom that are wrong. Some of us still imagine that it's just this place off up in the clouds that has nothing to do with the physical world, even though the Bible does not support that idea whatsoever, right? The Bible is pretty clear that what's going to happen is Jesus is going to come back, the dead are going to be raised, heaven's going to come down to earth, and we will dwell with God forever in the new heavens and the new earth, which means this physical world that's been created, it matters. It's a good thing. It's God's creation. Some people just have wrong ideas about who's going to be in there. Some people are really, really certain that they know who's in and who's out, right? Let me tell you something. You don't have a clue. You don't have a clue who's in and who's out. The very best you can hope for is to have your own personal assurance of salvation. You don't know what's going on with other people. And we're all going to be surprised by some of the people we meet in the kingdom and by some of the people we don't see in the kingdom. I mean, just look at, in the last few years, some of the horrifying revelations about people who were widely considered to be gold standards of Christian behavior, right? Ravi Zacharias, one of the most famous Christian apologists in the world, extremely influential, and after he died, he turns out to be a complete monster. All these stories come out about the way he sexually abused many, many women. Even his own family didn't know. They're horrified, right? I mean, it's just a horrible thing. Bill Hybels, not quite as horrific, but Bill Hybels is one of the most influential Christian leaders of the last 50 years, if not longer, and again, horrible sexual abuse scandals. Even in my own life, I in the last couple of years, this horrible thing has come out about the campus pastor of the campus ministry that my wife and I were a part of, that he was molesting his own children. And he wasn't the only one. One of the other campus pastors started doing the same thing to his children. And now there's this whole chain of things where multiple people, multiple leaders involved with that campus ministry and the churches that supported it, across the state of Texas and beyond, in fact, there's this like horrifying ring of that going on, which makes me glad I was only involved in it for like a year before I got busy and did other stuff. But now these were men and women who outwardly most people thought were holy and righteous. And that's just the revelations that come to light in this life. So we just, there are things we'll never know about people. We can't see into the depths of the hearts of the people around us. And so we have these revelations that come out about people in this life that are horrible. But we don't know what we don't know. There's people who we will not see in the kingdom who are going to, it's going to surprise us. And there's going to be people we think are just awful who are going to turn up there and we're going to be shocked. We have to get out of that mindset of thinking that we know who's going to be saved and who's not going to be saved, who's righteous and who's not righteous. Only God knows those things. Our job is not to determine who is righteous and who's not. Our job is not to determine who's going to get in and who's not. Our job is not to determine who's going to be powerful and influential and who's not. Our job is to love Jesus and love our neighbor. Our job is very simple. Be kind to people. Be loving. Be generous. Do the things Jesus told you to do and don't worry about status or power or influence. And this all has a very powerful message to us on a personal level. And I think if you take the time to really reflect on it, you might be surprised by how often you seek some level of status and influence, whether it's within your church, within your family, at your job. Now, it's not a bad thing to be given status. Sometimes it happens, right? Sometimes we really earn it. But you might be surprised by how often you realize you are deeply motivated by that desire to be an important figure, to be influential. And let me, as a pastor, I'll tell you, it's the kind of thing that creates a lot of toxicity in churches when there are people who want to be in roles of leadership purely because they are seeking the status and the influence that comes with it. And a whole lot of our churches are plagued with people who have been in important leadership positions for decades sometimes, not because they want to serve or because they are seeking the best things for the church, but because they like the status and the influence, and they're wrecking their churches for it. It happens. You wouldn't think that would happen in a church because most people don't think of church leadership roles as having a lot of status and influence, but within their own community, they do. And so that happens. And we all ought to reflect on that. Are we seeking status and influence and power in some way, or are we seeking to serve Jesus? Do we just want to be in the kingdom, or are we going to try and run the kingdom? And man, that's what it really boils down to, right? Do you want to be in the kingdom, or do you want to run the kingdom? In essence, that's kind of what the disciples are asking, right? Lord, are we going to be in positions of power to run the kingdom with you? And Jesus is saying, why don't you just be like this child who's just happy to be here, right? I think a lot of us would like to run the kingdom because we have our own ideas about how it should go. All of us ought to, when we read the Gospels, find things that Jesus says and does that we find a little objectionable, right? Because he pokes at all of our sin. If there's nothing in the Bible that troubles you, that you think, ooh, I don't know if I like that, you're either not paying enough attention or you are a much better Christian than me. Which I have to admit is a possibility. Do you want to be in the kingdom, or do you want to run the kingdom? And there is some humility involved there in the simple recognition that I can't do this as well as Jesus can, right? Now, Jesus is going to spend more time on this idea than you might think, right? So we go ahead into chapter 20, and he tells this parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. When he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them out into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to those he said, you go into the vineyard also, and whatever is right I will give you. And so they went. And he went out about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, and did the same thing. That's noon and 3 p.m., by the way. And about the 11th hour, so around 5, he went out and found others standing around, and he said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one's hired us. And he said to them, you go into the vineyard too. Now, this is at 5 p.m. Now when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, starting with the last group to the first. When those hired about the 11th hour came, each one received a denarius. And so when those hired first came, they thought that they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And when they received it, they grumbled at the landowner, saying, those who were hired last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day's work and the scorching heat. But he answered and said to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go. But I want to give to this last person the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I want with what is my own? Or is your eye envious because I am generous? So the last shall be first, and the first last. Now, a lot of times this parable gets interpreted as Jesus talking about the welcoming of Gentiles into the family of faith, right? And Jews being upset about that. Sometimes people compare it to like, well, what are you going to do if you've been a lifelong Christian and someone on their deathbed confesses to God and becomes a Christian and is still saved? And I mean, okay, fair, all that's true. But what he's really getting at, what he's really trying to get at is that in the kingdom, we're all equals. In the kingdom, this things that you think you've earned here, no. You go to the kingdom, you get what God gives you, and God's going to give the same to all of us. Eternal life. And so your motivation for working for Christ should not be to earn greater rewards than someone else, but to simply do what God asks you to do because you know that's what you should do. And don't worry about whether God's going to give you a greater reward than someone else. That's not what it's about. And see, this is a mindset that he really struggles to break with his disciples. Because we humans, we are obsessed with status. We're obsessed with reward, with who is better than who, all of that stuff. And Jesus is trying to say, forget it. Forget it. That is not how my kingdom works. I will give to everyone what I see fit to give them. And they still don't get it because this is what happens not long after that. It's still in Matthew chapter 20, just a couple verses ahead. And then the mother of the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, "What do you desire?" She said to him, "Say that in your kingdom these two sons of mine shall sit, one on at your right and one at your left." So again, she still has that mindset. They all still have that mindset of the kingdom being the literal kingdom of Israel, restored to its former glory, that Jesus is going to sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And she wants positions of power for her sons. She wants them to sit at his right hand and his left as his two most important advisors and officials. She wants power. And he said, and Jesus replied, "You do not know what you're asking." Boy, doesn't she, right? "Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." Again, they have no clue. He said to them, "My cup you shall drink," which should terrify them, but they don't know enough yet to be scared. "But to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And after hearing this, the other 10 disciples became indignant with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles domineer over them, and those in high position exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wants to become prominent among you shall be your servant, and whoever desires to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So first, I want to point something out to you, right? She asks, "In your kingdom, that one will sit at his right and at his left." It's worth pointing out that not very long after this, there is going to be someone seated on his right hand and someone at his left. And it's the two criminals who are nailed to the crosses next to him. In other translations, what she asks is, when the Son of Man is lifted up, grant that my sons shall sit at your right and at your left. Well, he's lifted up on the cross. And at his right and at his left are two other criminals who are crucified with him. That's who he's talking about when it says, but it is for them who have been prepared by my Father. Now, finally, he's had enough, as the disciples are squabbling over this request, and he just explicitly says, you are behaving like people of this world. If you're going to be in my kingdom, it doesn't work that way. You are servants. You are not the ones who were served. And then he points out that he himself came to serve and not to be served. Right? Now he's made explicit what he's been teaching this whole time. You are not to be served. You are to serve. Get it through your skulls, guys. This isn't about you. It's not about power. It's not about glory. It's not about becoming the rulers of a nation. It's about serving. Serving God and serving your neighbor. That's what the kingdom is about. That's how we win glory for Christ. We serve. And this is an idea that in the Western church has been kind of lost and abandoned. I mean, how often do we talk about amongst ourselves as Christians the need for us to have power and influence, right? How many people who call themselves Christians are going to be deeply upset if their candidate does not win the presidential election this year because they're going to be worried about losing the power and influence that their political party gains them? That's not the kingdom. That's not the kingdom. Our kingdom has nothing to do with the political power of this world. Our kingdom recognizes that the political power of this world is irrelevant. It's irrelevant to eternity. We serve a higher authority. And our job, our only job, is to serve, to love, not to seek power. Not to seek influence or control, but to serve. And we do this because Jesus came to serve. And he served right up to his death. We follow his example. We don't seek power. We don't seek influence. We don't seek control. All we ask is, how can we serve? I invite you to reflect on that this week. We'll be back next week with another podcast dealing with Lenten themes. Until then, God bless.